This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello there, Nikolai Vailhartz with you for The Country Hour today. Over the course of the next hour, the agribusiness giant Elders has just announced its full year results. Profits are up significantly. We'll find out why. Perhaps somewhat unsurprisingly, it does have something to do with high cattle prices and land prices at the moment as well. Also on the program today, I wonder if you know what a triploid oyster is. Well, it can be grown for longer periods of the year, helping oyster growers get them through the traditional spawning season. Now, SA growers can get access to them, so we'll find out what's changed there. To start today, though, the emissions footprint of the livestock sector has been one of the main talking points at the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow. So just how great is that footprint? Has it been overstated? Well, Matt Dalgleish, the manager of Commodity Market Insights at Thomas Elder Markets, told Angus Furley he believes there is an excessive focus on emissions from livestock.
Yeah, Angus, it was a bit disappointing, actually, from my perspective, to see that one of the big takeaways from COP26 was this methane pledge, which, look, I think that's not to say I'm anti-environmentalist, of course, but when you look at the numbers, and particularly when you look at the numbers with reference to livestock, as you say, the global emissions that livestock contribute are nothing compared to the emissions that come that are carbon-based rather than methane-based that are emitted by energy and transport.
So what are the numbers around livestock emissions?
So if you look at all livestock globally and the emissions they produce, 95% of those emissions are methane-based for livestock. It's 5.8% of global emissions that livestock are responsible for. When you contrast that to the emissions for, say, the energy and transport sector, that's at 73.2%. And the majority of those emissions are carbon-based. So it's there's a big difference, too, between a carbon-based emission and a methane-based emission.
And can you just explain that? Because, as I understand, methane does actually trap heat into the atmosphere more potently than carbon?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, it is one that, as a greenhouse gas, and they're the two main greenhouse gases. There's a handful of others, but from a global perspective, the big one's carbon and then the second largest is methane. But methane does capture more heat in it, so it is kind of, more potent, like you said. But the thing with methane, and particularly the methane emissions from livestock, is that it breaks down after about 10 or 12 years and returns back into carbon in the soil and carbon that the plants take up. So that methane emission that livestock produce is actually part of what they call the natural carbon cycle. And if you think about it, the planet and animals evolved on the planet, those grazing kind of ruminant animals like cattle and sheep and goats, they evolved to eat plants and grass, and then they emit the methane, which, breaks down after a decade or so back into carbon that can be taken up by plants to then fuel their growth again. So it's kind of part of the natural cycle. Whereas the carbon emissions that we emit from the burning of fossil fuels, they persist in the atmosphere for, they're not as potent, like you said, as methane, but they persist for hundreds of years, and they're the big one that's responsible for warming the planet. But it seems to be the focus is all on methane and livestock, which is, like I said, less than 6% of the global emissions and one that breaks down anyway and kind of goes back into the natural cycle.
And how about some of the other things that are said? Probably a couple of the big ones are that livestock are eating food that humans could be eating and livestock are being farmed on land that could be used to grow crops.
Yeah, from an Australian perspective, that's, in terms of the land to grow crops, is a particularly ridiculous statement. There's about, I think, 8% of the land on Australia's land mass is suitable for cropping, for human consumption cropping. So 8%. And so the vast bulk of the land mass of Australia is not suited to any cropping. And when you look at it from that perspective, about 50% of the land mass in Australia is actually managed by farmers and producers that are running pastoral type animals like cattle. So the bulk of the land mass is being used for what its probably best purpose is, which is to raise good quality meat protein. The point you made about, that we're feeding at these animals, globally we're feeding these animals food that we could be eating. That's actually not the case. If you look at what they're taking up globally as a species of livestock feed intake, 86% of the feed intake is feed that's not edible not eaten by humans. So that's another one of these kind of misinformation that's being spread about the impact of the livestock sector that gets someone like me quite frustrated when you see it out there.
So just finally, Matt, if you're saying that methane emissions from livestock is a problem that's being dramatically overstated, what's the motivation? Why is it being overstated?
Look, I suspect that there's more to it. You know, a lot of the times when you dig into social media and, you know, people on TED Talks and whatnot that are spruiking this environmental kind of damage that livestock are doing, you often find that they're stemming from actually an agenda that's not really environmental. It's more an anti-meat agenda or an anti, you know, the use of animal as a meat productive kind of system. It's a lot of those very hardcore activist vegan types that are promoting this on social media. So I suspect that there's a bit of a side agenda. They're kind of going under the guise of environmentalism, but in actual fact, what they're really wanting is to try and reduce people's consumption of red meat proteins because they don't want to see animals being used in that fashion. So I suspect that there's an aspect of that there. And I think from a farming agricultural perspective, I think, you know, we haven't had the history of say the energy and transport sector in being you know, kind of held out to be responsible for a lot of this environmental damage. I think the energy and transport sector have been a lot more sophisticated in their way they manage the narrative around it, and so they're being able to deflect you know, kind of attention, and they're probably more than happy that the livestock sector and agriculture more broadly is copying all this negative press because it's keeping you know the attention away from them as well.
That is Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Market speaking there with Angus Furley. It's just coming up to 12 past 12 on the Country Hour. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, with rapid antigen testing now available, a number of abattoirs are investing to try and avoid costly shutdowns from COVID-19 outbreaks. Across the country, we've seen a number of lengthy closures of meat processors that ended up disrupting the food supply chain. The CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council, Patrick Hutchinson, says the test kits are very expensive, though, especially when employees are tested multiple times a week.
We've been actually being able to access and utilise rapid antigen testing for some time now, certainly New South Wales, and now it's going into other states, you know, especially Victoria. I think that where it does very well for us is that it starts to put the onus back on the individual, on the employee, to make sure that they understand their obligations in regards to coming to work. So very much the same as, you know, every time you might go to a doctor or an optometrist or dentist or anything else, and they say to you, how are you feeling? You know, have you had these symptoms before coming in? We do and want to be saying that to our workers. Part of the armoury that we have to do that is obviously then also engaging them to undertake rapid antigen testing. The problem that we have is that a lot of our members are actually undertaking rapid antigen testing on almost all of their staff on a, you know, 1, 2, 3 times a week basis, and it becomes horrendously expensive. I've got one member in Victoria who's spending almost $85,000 a week on rapid antigen testing, but needs to. So there are some solutions that we've got to come to.
What's the price, though, compared to having to shut an abattoir down for a week or two under health directives from the government? Is it worth the money to be spending all of that cash on rapid antigen testing?
I suppose that it is one of the many investments that we've already made. Notwithstanding, as you and I have spoken about many times before, that as an industry, we were one of the early adopters in getting our staff fully vaccinated. We've been over the 85% full vax mark across the board on average for months now. So, you know, we know what it takes to get these things done, let alone the investments in our gold standard COVID safe plans. And that's what keeps the meat moving, and that's what keeps the food supply chain going. I think that with the additions of this, nationally what we find is that because we've got 6 states and 2 territories, there are different interpretations of what is required in order to keep the community, one, the community safe, and two, the food chain moving. Now, if I'm in South Australia, our ability to access rapid antigen testing is exceptionally difficult because it's still got to be provided by a health professional. Whereas in Victoria, as an example, we already know that rapid antigen testing is now available to the public. So I think it's less about do we need to keep making this because this investment because we may shut down. Because we've seen in this latest round with COVID-safe plans and vaccinations and the like, that in fact we're not seeing those shutdowns. We're seeing interventions, we're seeing reviews, and then we're seeing being moved on. Some places that have had a COVID issue haven't closed down at all. Some have closed down for a 24-hour period if that, and this is before rapid antigen testing. So I think that if governments are very keen to see our industry continue to use that, there's got to be an investment because there's a community good that goes with rapid antigen testing. And essentially, if it's already publicly available, it's going to be the push-pull mentality about how we get our workers to be utilising that themselves as opposed to industry having to continue to pay for it.
That is the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council, Patrick Hutchinson, speaking with Jane McNaughton.
You're listening to Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, South Australian oyster growers now have access again to an oyster that can provide cash flow all year round. Called the triploid oyster, it doesn't spawn, meaning it can be harvested and sold over the warmer months when the traditional diploid oyster is spawning and not suitable for consumption. South Australian growers have lost access to that triploid oyster when Pacific oyster mortality syndrome hit in Tasmania. Yumba Aquaculture is now breeding the triploid spat. Executive Director Ben Cameron says it's quite an interesting species.
The essence of a triploid oyster is very similar to a seedless watermelon. So it's essentially a seedless oyster. A lot of people would be familiar with a scallop's roe, you know, the orange part on the scallop. Well, the oyster, the roe, actually covers its entire body. And what happens is that in summertime, when it's breeding time for the oysters, they would normally spawn and release that roe out into the wild. And then your meat weight will suffer because they've gotten rid of all that roe. So essentially what a triploid oyster an oyster that doesn't produce that that spawn or that roe and makes meat instead.
So how come they haven't been accessible to SA growers recently?
So way back in 2016, there was a POMS virus that prevented us sending oysters from Tasmania to South Australia. And all of the triploid oysters, in fact, all of the oysters, or vast majority of the oysters, came from Tasmania to South Australia as spat, as the baby. So when that happened, Tasmanian hatcheries came and helped set up and helped the other existing South Australian hatcheries sort of gear up to produce all of the South Australian oysters now locally in South Australia. And through that process, we had to develop all of the techniques that worked and were easy and well known to us in Tasmania and adapt those to the South Australian environment, water quality, etc. So in doing that, we start off with a very easy product, which is the diploid oysters, and they weren't all that easy. So we then, by the time we got to supplying all of South Australia with diploid oysters, which is the vast majority of the crop, we then started looking at the specialty products like triploids. So we've sort of had a focus on making sure that we get good commercial outcomes for growers for the majority of the year first, and now we're doing the more technically difficult process with triploids a couple of years later.
How much of a difference was there to producing these triploid oysters in South Australia to what you were doing in Tasmania?
So there's actually a huge amount. And as you would imagine, you know, I'm sure you're an enjoyer of oysters. And if you've tried oysters from South Australia and from Tasmania or from New South Wales, you actually taste in the oyster the difference between the different geographic regions. Well, believe it or not, it actually makes a huge difference to the breeding process as well. So the natural elements that are in the water, the natural bacteria that are in the water, right down to the different seaweeds in the water can change the chemistry of the seawater that we use for the breeding. And that has an impact on what we need to do in the hatchery to make sure we get good commercial outcomes. So we had a fair bit of relearning to do. We knew all the basics, but then we just had to make sure we could tailor that to be South Australian specific.
So does that mean that you'll now focus solely on triploid oysters, or is there still a market for the diploid oysters?
Yeah, good question. I think that the diploid oysters are certainly the biggest part of the market. I think most people would continue to have the majority of their crop or their on-farm stock in South Australia as diploids. However, the triploids are one of those niche things that over summertime, if you're trying to maintain cash flow, it's actually quite beneficial to have a percentage of your crop being the triploids. So you know, I certainly imagine that the demand for diploids will be very high. That's what we focused on them to begin with. But I don't imagine that everybody would want to have their whole crop as triploids. They're more expensive and they can be a little bit more fiddly in terms of animal husbandry perspective for the growers on farm.
What does it mean for growers to have access to the triploid oyster spat now?
I think cash flow, to be honest, is king to most small businesses. And when your oysters spawn, we don't always know when they're going to spawn. So maybe they spawn before Christmas, maybe they spawn after Christmas, maybe they spawn early this year and go in November. Well, if you've got a bit of a backup just with a percentage of your farm being triploids, then hopefully you can supply market, a bit of market maintenance so that you've got a continued presence. But also, of course, cash. Cash flow is king for most small businesses. So the ability to keep selling through that window, I think, will be greatly advantageous to South Australian growers.
I guess
that is Yumba Aquaculture Breeding Executive Director Ben Cameron speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. Now, I wonder if you really know what's healthy and what's not when you're filling up your shopping trolley. Well, to try and help consumers research and improve their diets, a new database is being developed by Food Standards Australia New Zealand, which will support current public health initiatives, things like the Health Star rating system. FSAN's General Manager of Science and Risk Assessment, Crystal Lemus, spoke with Jane McNaughton.
The database is important as it will provide a central and open source of brand-specific information, including the nutrient content, to help people make informed decisions about the foods and beverages they buy and consume. It will also help inform food standards development work, as well as public health and nutrition initiatives such as the Health Star rating system and reformulation work under the Australian Government's Healthy Food Partnership.
You mentioned the Health Star rating system there. There has been some complaints about the way in which that's structured. For example, there was a big debate late last year and at the start of this year about orange juice being a lower Health Star rating than diet soft drink. So why should people trust this database?
So the database will provide data and evidence to support the Health Star rating system. While a monitoring framework for the HSR system is still being developed by the Department of Health, we expect that the branded food database will be an important element of that monitoring. So it will allow us to track Health Star rating over time. So it will allow us to check for changes in Health Star ratings by manufacturers, as well as changes in the nutrient profile of foods over time. So the database is targeted at providing a reliable source of data for modelling of any future HSR changes.
So it would be more comprehensive than the Health Star rating system. For example, it would, in the case of orange juice, would take into account the fact that if it's freshly squeezed, just 100% orange juice in a bottle, that it would have some kind of nutrient benefit and it's not just going to be judging a product on sugar, for example. So is there a guarantee that this database could be more comprehensive?
So the database will be more comprehensive in terms of allowing us to showcase the full breadth of the food supply in terms of what is the nutrient composition of a range of food products. So it's not designed to replace the HSR system. The HSR system continues, but it will allow us to better track and monitor the HSR system, including the uptake of the system over time, as well as any changes in nutrient composition in the food supply.
Is this an opt-in position that companies can take?
It's not mandatory to provide data, but by providing data and giving permission for it to be published through this database, manufacturers and retailers will contribute to industry transparency while supporting the development of a single source of truth database with credible product information that is accurate, comprehensive and updated regularly.
If the companies are providing you with the data for this, what are the checks and balances to make sure that they're being truthful and honest about what's in their products?
So that's a great question. In our data collection, we have a number of sources that we'll get that data from, including GS1, as well as a portal that will be developed. But once we get that data, we do data checking, we do the storage and analysis. So we do actually compare that to our existing food composition databases, so that will allow us to identify if there are any products with a nutrient profile that doesn't look quite right. And so we are really cognizant of ensuring that data is really accurate in our processes.
So when do you think that this database will be up and running?
Data collection will commence from January 2022 for existing GS1 Australia registered members. So that product catalogue will come directly into our database for data checking, and other manufacturers and retailers will be able to submit data via the PZAMS online portal, which is expected to be operational by mid-2022. And beyond that, we are hoping to have 85% of products in the marketplace within this database by 2023.
That is Crystal Lemus from Food Standards Australia New Zealand speaking with Jane McNaughton. Well, let's now head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster Simon Timke is on duty. Afternoon, Simon.
G'day, Nicola.
Felt like a very chilly morning this morning.
Yeah, look, it was cool in parts, but in the south of the state, there was enough cloud to stop it getting too cold. Still a little bit of shower activity around at the moment. Looking at the latest satellite picture, we do have plenty of cloud persisting over the south. Little bit of high cloud right up in the far northwest, but across the north of the state, plenty of sunshine to, I guess, to help dry things out a little bit up that way. And that's pretty much the story for the rest of the day too, I think, where there are likely to be a couple of showers around over mostly over the agricultural area, but particularly the southern agricultural area. And looking at the radar at the moment, plenty of showers around the Mount Lofty Ranges, Kangaroo Island, and the eastern districts. Up around the mid-north too is a chance, but by tomorrow, we'll see most of those clear away. For Tuesday, still just a slight chance of a shower about sort of the northern Gulf coasts and possibly about the lower southeast district as well, and then a chance right out in the far west of about Nullarbor, where there could be a thunderstorm as well. But generally, they're not expecting any significant totals for Tuesday. For most of the state, it will be a dry day. On Wednesday, we'll see some middle-level cloud move across and bring a slight chance of showers about the southern agricultural area and western districts. Unlikely to see any big falls, but there will be the odd shower around, and possibly a thunderstorm sort of west of about Streaky Bay for Wednesday. And the winds are tending around more northerly, so we'll start to see temperatures rise a little bit that day as well, and getting very hot out in the very far west near the western border. Thursday, we'll see a trough move across western parts of the state, and the chances of showers increasing. So for Wednesday, slight chance of shower about the... up to Thursday, slight chance of showers, slight to medium chance of showers in the west, also about southern and eastern parts of the agricultural area, and possible thunderstorms in the west, also in the southeast on Thursday morning, I think. So starting to see some more interesting weather as that change moves across. We'll see the northeast and northwesterly winds turn around more south to southeasterly behind that change. That change over the west and sort of near southern coast late morning, moving across most parts during the day, so that by Friday it's right up in the far north of the state in the morning. We'll see some more middle-level cloud push some showers across on Friday. Possible about particularly West Coast District and adjacent parts of the Northwest Pastoral District into Eyre Peninsula as well. Only a slight chance of showers on Friday about eastern districts. And then over the weekend, things get interesting again. We've got another complex low pressure system moving across from the west. So as with the last one, we'll see areas of rain, but where that rain ends up falling very much depends on the position of the low. And there is a level of uncertainty, as always, with these complex low pressure systems. So we'll be watching the weekend closely to see where rain falls, but certainly a high chance of some showers over some parts of the state over the weekend. As far as the rainfall totals go for that period out to the end of Friday, generally less than 2 millimetres over the agricultural area, but reaching 2 to 5 about the lower southeast and Kangaroo Island, 5 to 15 millimetres possible about the Flinders district far south of the pastoral districts, also central and western parts of the West Coast district, and in the far west we could see falls of 15 to 30 millimetres, Nikolai.
Okay, thanks so much, Simon. That's Simon Timke on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology for Upper Western New South Wales for tomorrow. Mostly sunny day, overnight temperatures falling to between 8 and 12, daytime temperatures reaching the low to high 20s. For Lower Western New South Wales tomorrow, a partly cloudy day. Overnight temperatures falling to between 6 and 10, with daytime temperatures reaching the low 20s. It's just coming up to 12:30.
listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Nikolai Bailharts. Nikolai Bailharts.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for joining us today. I've got a question for you this lunchtime that you may be more used to hearing during those fancy red carpet Hollywood events. Who are you wearing? Or in this case, what are you wearing? Have you got a cotton shirt on? Maybe a woolen jumper, given how chilly it was in some parts earlier today. The reason I ask, well, there's a fair bit of concern in the natural textile market at the moment in Australia about how some proposed changes to how clothing can be marketed, particularly when it comes to the word sustainable. And the question really is revolving around whether or not synthetic materials could end up having a better sustainability rating than natural fibres.
Customers want to feel confident that when they are reading about a product's credentials, they can trust them. But because we don't have a standard methodology behind labelling in fashion, it can be very difficult to know what you're buying.
And that, of course, does have a significant effect on Australian agricultural producers. But I'm keen to hear from you this afternoon. When you are doing a bit of clothes shopping, do you check the label to see what an item's made of? Do you look for words like sustainable? Do you care? Or is price really king at the end of the day? You can always send us a text on 0467 922 891. The text number 0467 922 891. First, though, we need to get the latest in news headlines with Emma Rebellato. Afternoon, Emma.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. Some industries are still waiting to hear how rules will affect them when South Australia's borders reopen next week. The state government's revealed some rules, though, for the general population. People who are fully vaccinated will only have to quarantine for 7 days if they're a close contact of a positive case, and if they're a casual contact, they'll only have to isolate until their first negative test. Businesses won't have to close for a deep clean either if they have a positive case there, but sectors like education and transport are still waiting to find out more. The federal government's digging in over its 2030 emissions reduction target. Labor and the Greens want more action, and now Liberal backbenchers are joining the calls. And 7 years after William Tyrrell went missing, New South Wales police are launching a new search for him, saying they are looking for his remains. William Tyrrell was 3 years old when he went missing from his foster grandmother's house in September 2014. We'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks so much, Emma Rebellato there with news headlines. Well, as I say, it is time to talk textiles and fibres. Almost literally the shirt on your back right now, because wool, cotton and mohair are industries that have often competed against each other, but they've now come together to take on new textile labelling laws in Europe with concerns that they could spread to Australia. The Make the Label Count campaign is aiming to influence proposed EU labelling laws, which would see the little swing tags that you see attached to clothing show a sustainability rating on every fashion garment. However, there are some concerns that the current plan will leave natural fibres, things like wool and cotton, worse off compared to synthetic textiles. So I would be keen to know, as I say, do you care about the fibre you wear? The text number 0467 922 891 if you'd like to join in. 0467 922 891. Josh Becker takes a look at this issue.
The European Union is currently working through a plan to introduce a product environmental footprint methodology, which would essentially label products, including textiles, with their sustainability credentials. Claire Press is a sustainable fashion expert and the presenter of the Wardrobe Crisis podcast. She explains there are concerns that the current approach may not give consumers the full story.
In sustainability, we've got a bit of a problem that there's no standard methodology or standard agreement on what we mean when we talk about a more sustainable product. And there are so many different factors that come into play, whether, for example, if you want to look at textiles, it's got a low carbon footprint, or it's recyclable, or it's been produced with social welfare and decent working conditions in mind. So there's all these different things that come into play. And when policymakers or lawmakers start trying to set laws and standards and regulations about how we talk about these things, they need to take all these different factors into account. And at the moment, there is some controversy around this EU proposal because the methodology that they are using excludes some really key things. And the concern is that it favours synthetic textiles because they could be more recyclable. In some cases, they're produced with a lower carbon footprint, lower water use. However, when it comes to things like cotton and wool, it's also really important to look at how farmers are treating the land and using regenerative practices, for example. And then a really big one is synthetic fiber pollution, so microfiber pollution that ends up in our oceans. But according to Fashion Revolution, something like 34% of microplastic pollution in the oceans comes from our textiles.
Delina White, Secretary General of the International Wool Textiles Organization based in Brussels, says the current methodology will leave natural fibers like wool, cotton and mohair worse off.
We'll have a serious implication for our natural fiber industry right through to our farmers, which are the most vulnerable in this position, really. We have to understand that at the moment the playing field is not fair, it's not level.
The recently launched Make the Label Count campaign brings together Australian Wool Innovation, Cotton Australia, as well as anti-plastics campaigners, all to argue that the methodology needs to change.
So from the perspective of natural fibres, we know that the rest of the world are really trying to cut down on the use of fossil fuels, and we see that somehow that point is not really being elaborated on in the process when we talk about textiles. So when we look at biodegradability, that is currently not accounted for in the PEF process, microplastic pollution, which we know is a huge issue on our planet, is not accounted for. And then the fact that our natural fibers come from renewable sources, that fact is not being accounted for.
Claire Press says regulation is needed to address current problems with labelling.
Yes, greenwashing is a real problem in this industry. As more customers demand or look for greener and more eco-friendly products, of course, marketers rush to try to sell them those things. So examples could be right now, for example, the fast fashion giant H&M is pushing a PETA-friendly vegan collection, and the intimation is that that is also friendly for the planet. But coming back to this idea of synthetics, microfibers, and also the fact that they're derived from petroleum and fossil fuels, that's not the case. So I think there's a lot of worry about greenwashing. Customers want to feel confident that when they are reading about a product's credentials, they can trust them. But because we don't have a standard methodology behind labelling in fashion, it can be very difficult to know what you're buying. I think that what the EU and the European Commission is doing around eco-design and these proposals around labelling and sustainability is fantastic. I'd love to see us do it in Australia. The EU's leading on this and it's brilliant. Now, personally, my view is that wool is a fantastic fibre. It's basically natural, biodegradable, requires only sunlight and feedstock to produce. And if you look at circularity and fashion waste, then I think natural fibres are the way to go. But I also do see the kind of argument for recyclability, which is what's underpinning some of this push towards synthetics if they are not virgin, if you like. But I think what I would say is that this is complex, and there isn't, in sustainability, there's rarely an A or B answer. It's always A or B, providing ... and you have to look at the different criteria.
Claire Press says until these labels are introduced, consumers can play a role in changing the industry.
I think if you're listening as a consumer or someone who buys clothes, one thing I would say is don't think this doesn't relate to you because you're not in fashion. This is all the clothes that we buy, workwear, kids wear, uniforms, whatever you wear on the farm. It's all made of textiles, right? So this is relevant to you. As a consumer, I think that you kind of need to take your power back a little bit here and ask more questions of the brands from which you buy about how they make their clothes. And until we do have universal standardized labeling for sustainability, I think the onus is kind of on the consumer to do a bit more research and ask more difficult questions of brands about how they produce their stuff.
So there you go. That's you. Time to ask some more questions by the sounds of things. That's Claire Press, sustainable fashion expert and also presenter of the Wardrobe Crisis podcast. Ending that report from Josh Becker, and heaps of your texts coming through on this issue. Thanks for sending them through. One person, Bronwyn, says, I only ever wear cotton, wool or silk as they breathe. Having a skin condition, they breathe. Synthetics don't. Synthetics irritate my skin. Another text saying, I always look for natural fibres. So important. They keep you warmer, they last longer and break down in the environment and support farmers. No polyester here. Ruth's been in touch as well, saying synthetics are no good for your body.
And when it comes to the disposal, they end up in the sea. Ruth says we need to get rid of cotton and grow and develop manufacturing for beautiful industrial hemp fabric. It's long-lasting. Alan from West Beach has been in touch too, saying great to see some advances in sustainability, but the amount of plastic waste and packaging that these garments are delivered in is also concerning. That's from Big L, so good point there too. If you'd like to join in that conversation, please do. 0467 922 891 is the text number. 0467 922 891 as that campaign, the Make the Label Count campaign, trying to influence those proposed EU labelling laws, particularly in this aspect when it comes to sustainability too. How important is that idea of sustainability? A few people highlighting that does rate for them. You know, always that question of how it interacts with price too, isn't it? 0467 922 891 is the text number. 0467 922 891.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And my name's Nikolai Bailharts. It's 19 minutes to one. Well, SA Health says it's looking into why there's been a spike in cases of gastro linked to the consumption of raw oysters. SA Health's Acting Director of Food and Controlled Drugs Branch, Joanna Caymans, says there's been 36 cases linked to eating raw oysters since September 2021, compared to none last year. As she told Brooke Neindorf, they're looking into where the bug may have been picked up.
We've seen a number of cases arising from people that have been eating raw oysters in particular. So to date, we've had 36 cases of people getting sick from eating the oysters. And so that is always obviously a trigger for us to investigate what's happened there.
How does it compare to the previous years?
Yeah, so it is quite a high number of cases. So as I said, we've had 36 cases of Vibrio parahaemolyticus infection linked to eating raw oysters since September 2021, and that's compared to no cases in 2020 and only 8 cases in 2019.
Is there any reason why this might be the case that there's more this year?
No, it's really hard to know. Vibrio is a bacteria that lives in the environment. It tends to be happy living in warm marine environments. So oysters, as you might know, grow in sort of those warm tidal areas. And unfortunately, sometimes the Vibrio numbers in the environment spike for some reason and can, you know, infect the oysters. So we're still looking into what's actually happened there and why the numbers might be so high at the moment.
Can the infection be linked to the oyster in the water, or can it be picked up along the journey to the consumer?
Look, both. It can be filtered through the oyster from the surrounding water, but there is always a chance that it could be contaminated in the processing of the oyster itself once it's pulled out of the water.
What sort of symptoms are seen with this?
Yeah, so typical symptoms of gastro onset can be usually occurring within 24 hours, can be as early as 4 hours of eating the food. And the symptoms are watery diarrhea, abdominal cramps, nausea, vomiting and fever.
And do you then trace back to what they have eaten in the past 24 hours?
Yeah, that's right. When we start to see a few cases coming through, our Communicable Disease Control Branch will go out and interview those people and ask for their food history over the last few days. And in this case, it became evident that virtually all of these people had eaten raw oysters during the incubation time period, so that obviously was a fairly clear pointer that that was the source, although, as I say, we are still investigating that.
What work does SA Health do with the oyster industry to see what might be the issue and what might be causing this?
Yeah, well, look, the Department of Primary Industries and Regions is actually the regulator of the oyster growing areas. So they've been working really closely with those industries just to see what might have happened and if that can be resolved. So, yeah, we have also talked to some of those areas, but mostly it's been PIRZA.
PIRZA have said that inspections by PIRZA officers have found that food safety practices are being appropriately applied on oyster farms. Do you speak to consumers about how they maybe have stored the raw oysters before they've eaten them and things like that to gather information in the lead-up?
Yeah, we certainly do. We try to investigate all sorts of things. As you can understand, it's sometimes a bit of a puzzle to work out exactly what's happened in every situation, and there's different exposures. Yeah, we certainly ask people how they've stored their oysters, how they've transported them, where they've eaten them. So, yeah, there could be a range of factors involved.
Where does SA Health go from here with looking at these cases?
Look, we are just at the moment just monitoring the case numbers, and again working with PIRSA and the industries to try to get to the bottom of what might be happening here. Look, I think hopefully this will just resolve itself. For most people, the illness is not a dangerous one. It's obviously unpleasant, but generally most people recover after a couple of days. However, we are just taking the opportunity of reminding people who have lowered immune systems, so that includes people who are elderly or taking immunosuppressing drugs, not to eat raw seafood. And that's a message that we would generally tell people, not just at the moment, because there's always a risk that Vibrio or some other organism could be in those raw seafood items, and that can affect people quite badly if they do have that lowered immune system.
That is SA Health's Acting Director of Food and Controlled Drugs Branch, Joanne Kamen, speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. The ABC has been in touch with the South Australian oyster industry for comment as well. And we are getting more and more of your comments and texts through on whether you care particularly what kind of fabrics you're wearing. This is off the news that the EU is looking at how to rank the sustainability of fibres. Naomi from the Mid-North says fibres that Australia should look at or keep are wool, bamboo and hemp, but not cotton. All those textiles will break down naturally, so wool textiles will get credit on the end of their lives. And Macy has been in touch too, saying no to synthetics. It has to be human and environmentally friendly and breathable. The use of wool and hemp and silk, natural fibres, is the only way to go. If you would like to send us a text, the text line always open, 0467 922 891.
Hello, Costa here. Gardening is great for the whole family, and I want to tell you something that will get the kids in your life growing. It's my brand new podcast, Gardening Buds. Everything a kid needs to know to make their own garden grow. Whether you've got a big backyard, a balcony, or a little pot on a windowsill. Join Kaylee and I for Gardening Buds. Out now on the ABC Kids Listen and ABC Listen apps.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, it is 13 to 1. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, the agribusiness giant Elders says profits are at a decade-long high, driven by high commodity prices like livestock, but also due to a boom, at least in part, in rural real estate. Elders has reported a statutory net profit after tax of $149.8 million. The South Australian-based company says it will continue to look at expanding too, depending on where it sees that as appropriate. And Elders CEO Mark Ellison joins us. Mark Ellison, thanks for your time.
Great to be here.
I imagine you're pleased with these results. What's driven them?
Yeah, no, it's a very positive next step for Elders as we've been kind of re-establishing and growing over the last few years. I think the strong market conditions has been one aspect, but as we pointed out in the presentation this morning, it really only accounts for 30% of the growth year on year, the strong market conditions and seasons and commodity prices. And there's been 70% has come from other self-help initiatives that the business has in place. So we're seeing continued growth and a continued ability to reinvest in regional rural Australia. And to, Elders has been in Australia now for 182 years. Our core DNA is regional rural Australia and agriculture, and we feel happy that we can contribute more as we grow more.
So of those seasonal conditions, I imagine it's things like we've talked quite a bit about high livestock prices, but also high rural real estate prices?
Yeah, no, they've been very strong. I think starting on real estate, our sense, particularly in the farmland sector, which is the bigger holding sector, but we thought with the reduction of Chinese capital coming into that market that we may see a softening, but with local family money and also Canadian super funds, there's been significant investment and competition there. On the livestock prices, but for us, high livestock prices is good for our agency business, and that's been moving along strongly. And it's not so good for our feed and processing business, which has had its profitability halved through that same period. So one of the beauties of Elders' business model is that we have multiple diversifications, and through geographies, crop segments, species, access channel to market, and that allows us to be able to offset like hardcore seasonal or commodity cycle impacts.
On the real estate side of things, we've heard for a couple of years now, and this is by no means exclusive to Elders, but a Canadian super really has shown a lot of interest in Australian agriculture. Would you like to see Australian super showing more interest in agriculture?
I absolutely, completely agree with you. I mean, I'm chair of Agribusiness Australia. It's another role, and the Future Fund doesn't tend to invest in agriculture in Australia. And you know, from a regional rural Australian viewpoint, and from an agricultural viewpoint, it just makes sense because you know, we have our pre-farmgate target of producing $100 billion by 2030. We're back to $70 billion this year, so we're back on track with that. And this is a significant growth area and an important industry for Australia and the export market.
Is it a bit of a double-edged sword for the real estate side of things on a much more local level in that, you know, if you own property and you've seen that value rise, great when you're selling, but if you're a younger person trying to get in, it's a bit like buying a house in Sydney or Melbourne, you're getting priced out.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult in the capital cities, but also the big regional cities. But we've seen a strengthening in our regional rural, residential business, and there may be a drift occurring, as I think a lot of people have predicted, from city areas into more regional areas. But you're right, it's just very, very difficult. I mean, how a young couple can afford to invest in a property in a major city is very, very difficult.
You touched too on input prices, and fertiliser has been one that's been talked about quite a lot, that a number of nations are cutting back how much fertiliser that they're exporting. Is that an area of concern to you, that fertilisers may be just getting too expensive to justify for farmers?
It's a good question because both Russia and China have held back production, some of their production for their domestic use, which they have a sovereign right to do. I think the issue coming into next year's winter crop and also in Northern Australia, the summer crop that's coming in now, is around having the volume commitments. And from Elders' viewpoint, with in East Coast, so Western Australia, but we're comfortable with how the volume commitments there. For Eastern Australia, we've got a few suppliers, but I think locking in the volume is the critical point. And then, because prices have been going up significantly with the pressure on production around the world and volumes being withdrawn from the market, as you said, I think the price issue will be a later issue as we come closer into the season.
And how hopeful are you more broadly that the good times in agriculture will continue? Because we've seen some positive forecasts, but at the same time, recent storms have been welcomed in some areas but seem to have done quite a bit of damage in others. Are you hopeful for the short term for agriculture?
I'm very, very optimistic. I think that there have been some like rain recently in the last week that's upset some of the harvesting and damaged some crops and reduced yield, etc. That goes part and parcel with agriculture. It doesn't feel like it's widespread, but obviously for those that are impacted, it's significant. I think the outlook for at least the next 18 months, 2 years for Australian agriculture is very, very strong. One of the clouds on the horizon has been access to overseas markets and the potential of not being able to sell the product we produce. I think we've shown with the China tensions that we've been able to find alternative markets in a number of areas. It's really only the crayfish industry in Western Australia that hasn't been, but they were quite leveraged to China with 90% plus going to China. But I think other markets have opened up. We've got our strong Indonesian markets. We've got ASEAN, the comprehensive agreement that was announced last week. We've got a free trade agreement with India being negotiated at the moment. The same with the UK and the EU. So I actually feel very optimistic about it.
Mark Ellison, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
That's Mark Ellison, the CEO of Elders. It is just coming up to 6 to 1. My name's Nikolai Beilharts. And as I just mentioned then, we have been speaking quite a bit lately about those storms that have done huge amounts of damage in the hundreds of millions of dollars in some areas. And if you are a farmer or you've been feeling stressed amidst these recent damaging storms and heavy rains, there is a reminder, don't forget, you're not alone. Clinical psychologist and World at End farmer Stephanie Schmidt, who founded Act for Ag, says she wants farmers to remember they are more than their crops.
For so many people across SA, it's been so dry for so long and then so many uncertainties. Then to have the rain and then the really severe, in some patches, the hailstorms damage, it's a pretty devastating time at a time that's also fairly stressful at the best of times as well. So it's a hard time for a lot of people, I think.
What are some of the important messages that you want to make sure is on the forefront of people's mind at this time?
What I want to get out there with Act for Ag, and really, I guess, through my experience as a psychologist, but also living the everyday challenges of farming, it's about finding those small ways to look after ourselves every single day. So putting in place little steps to take care of ourselves in kind of the calm times, but also the stressful times as well, because I think particularly for farming, there's always some kind of stressor that's happening. And then when you throw in these storms or the hail event, things can get pretty stressful and severe pretty fast. And so I think at the moment it's just helping us remember to take that step back at times and really to think about what is most important to me or as a family, what is important to you and your business, and to be able to zoom out, because I guess during times of stress, our brain likes to zoom in on the crisis and the stress that's at hand, but be able to take that step back and think about what's really most important to you. And I put a bit of a message out on social media, which was just that reminder that we're so much more than our farms as well. I think so often farmers get really strongly identified because we live on farm. Our life really revolves around farming. But just remembering that there's so much else about you and all those things that are important to you and to the people around you as well.
And what has the response been like to that post?
Yeah, there's been some really positive interactions and that reminder from others that it's just an important thing to remember, because I guess we do get so wrapped up in the success of harvest. And I think particularly, I mean, I even see in our own family when it's been so stressful over the last few years and so much riding on wanting to get the crop off this year and get some income coming in, it can often feel like a personal failure when things don't go right. But it's just that reminder for people that if things fall apart on the farm, that's not you failing as a person. There's so much that's outside of your control as well. So yeah, I guess just the people have found it really helpful to be able to remember to focus on what's in our control rather than focusing all the time on what's outside of our control.
A recent report found that farmers are working more days than ever, which is probably no surprise to you. How can people find the time out when it just sort of seems like the pressures just continue to mount?
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that one. I was kind of reflecting myself. I was listening to a bit of a energy management podcast talking about needing to prioritise sleep and kind of laughing to myself, because at 9 o'clock at night at the moment, I've often got the three kids asleep in the back of the ute and helping my husband shift around paddocks and things. So taking those steps to prioritise our well-being in these stressful times, it is hard on farm because the hours are long and the pressure's there. But yeah, whether it is just remembering to get that extra sleep when you can, or even just those day-to-day aspects of the same as we make sure the fuel going in our tractor and our machinery is the right kind of fuel, making sure you're fueling your body with enough water and relatively nutritious food as well. And then even just setting some little reminders of the things that help you to stay on track, whether it's taking 5 minutes out to call a friend or go for a walk, not when it's bucketing down with rain, but just those little ways. And I think particularly during these stressful times on farm, it can be really easy to get caught up on autopilot doing all the things that we have to do. But remembering that if we take our time to look after ourselves to start with, it can then have that flow-on effect in making everything a bit more effective after that.
That is clinical psychologist and farmer Stephanie Schmidt speaking with Eliza Berlart. She can, of course, contact Lifeline on 13 11 14 if you need to, and South Australian rural residents can also contact 1300 032 186. Let's find out what's coming up on Afternoons with Sonia Feldhoff. Afternoons.
Thanks, Nicolai. Yeah, well, of course, we're all still trying to get to the bottom of all the new changes under the roadmap released today and some of the detail. To help with some of the nuance of individual circumstances, the Premier Stephen Marshall will be joining me first up on the program.
Oh, very good. All right, that and plenty more. Thanks very much.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.